The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation, and I'm coming to you today from Pennsylvania, one of the most crucial swing states in this election, and the place where Kamala Harris unveiled her vice presidential running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, at a packed Philadelphia rally earlier this week. It's safe to say that Harris's selection of Walz has been met with rapturous approval from Democratic voters. But who is Tim Walz? Can he help Harris win in November? And what does his ascension say about the kind of president Kamala Harris could be? To discuss all of this, I'm joined by The Nation's Washington bureau chief, Chris Lehman, another proud son of the Midwest, and Alyssa Auersler, a Minneapolis-based journalist and the author of the newsletter Fear and Self-Loathing on the 24 Election Trail, which you can get wherever you get Substack. Welcome, both of you, to See How They Run. So let's start off with Tim Walz. There was an interesting story in the Times today that seemed to suggest that rather than being picked out of a hat, as it were, Tim Walz had been waging a quiet campaign to get noticed over the last year. So I wondered whether he knew something we didn't know about, or whether this is just standard procedure for Midwestern governors. Chris, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I think waging a quiet campaign for anything is a Midwestern trait, definitely. I think Walz's ascension is shocking chiefly to kind of the pundit establishment, because they were sort of reading, as is their wont, you know, the red-blue diptych of the electoral map. And as you mentioned in your introduction, Don, Pennsylvania is one of the biggest purple states out there. And so the logic, you know, for a lot of establishment pundits was obviously you go with Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, who's very popular, and, you know, nail down those 18 electoral votes. But, you know, the case for Walz, and I'm sure Alyssa can speak to this much more expansively, is that the industrial Midwest and the upper Midwest specifically was known ever since the 2012 election as the blue firewall for the Democrats. And famously in 2016, they lost that firewall. And there were lots of long-term reasons for that loss. One of them was clearly the kind of steady loss of manufacturing jobs in the former Rust Belt. And Walz, as a kind of traditional Democratic former labor type populist, spoke very directly to those kind of issues. And you saw it in his rollout, where he touted his record both in Congress and particularly as governor of achieving basic social democratic quality of life gains, things like free school lunches, things like what am I blanking on here? Maybe Alyssa can.
We can get into that in a second. I just want to say, you know, that you're absolutely right, Chris, that the punditocracy was all in for Shapiro. And that was, I suppose, my initial thrill when I found out that it was Walz, was that, you know, this'll show him. And particularly because it wasn't just the, you know, the punditocracy is a big beast. This was the centrist punditocracy. So, you know, there was a, you know, the sort of Nate Cohns, Jonathan Chaits, who were pushing Harris to the center and who will continue pushing Harris to the center through the election. And God help us after the election, should she be successful, we're pushing hard for Shapiro. So, you know, I loved it that she didn't cave. We'll get to why one might want to temper one's enthusiasm a bit in a second, Alyssa, but let's as a Minnesotan, let's get to the case for Waltz first. What has happened in Minnesota that other progressives might take heart from or want to emulate?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, as Chris alluded to, I think it's kind of a reclaiming of trying to be the party of the people. And I think Waltz is kind of the perfect figure for that. I think it was in the New York Times, someone described him as a battleground strategy dressed in Carhartt. And so he just, like, I mean, and as you also mentioned, like, this didn't happen overnight. I mean, it was part of a campaign to ensure he had this really, like, down home image, right? But you also can't fake it. So you have images of him, you know, holding a pig or being hugged by kids for the free lunch, the law for free lunches in schools. And I think it's been, he also really kind of changed the discursive footing of the election, like, pretty quickly. I mean, he's been calling Trump weird since February, but of course that was before, you know, we knew he was a candidate to be the vice president, but that really caught on. And so I think we kind of went from being like, this is a fight to save democracy, to being like, those guys are weird. That was a huge shift. And then I really do think this, like, rebranding of small town values as liberal ones, I think he has the track record for it to stick and kind of the personality for that to land with people. And I think that's what we're seeing.
Well, one of the things that fascinated me about the story about this behind the scenes effort was that one of the key players in it was Jane Kleb, who's the chair of the Democratic Party of Nebraska and was a Bernie person and is one of the few people in my experience who is a real left populist within the establishment of the Democratic Party. I mean, you know, we can, although I'm really tired of relitigating what happened in 2016, but what definitely didn't happen in 2016 was a populist offer. You know, if you wanted populism in 2016, you had to go to Donald Trump. It was fake populism, but it was at least had the label on it. And, you know, what intrigues me about Waltz is that he seems to be plausibly a prairie populist, which is a real thing. It used to be a real thing in both parties. You know, it reached in a way its apogee in the Democratic Party under William Jennings Bryan in 1892 and 1896. But, you know, it's still, if you think about Tom Harkin, if you think about, you know, this was a big strand of the Democratic Party. It's, you know, those of us who are not from Minnesota don't always remember that the official name of the party in Minnesota is the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. You know, that is a very different vision of the Democratic Party than the Democratic, we take money from Wall Street and we're going to deindustrialize American manufacturing Bill Clinton Party. So, you know, go ahead and tell me I'm wrong, but it seems to me that in that sense, Waltz sends some very encouraging signals for progressives.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, the whole time I grew up in Iowa, just south of Minnesota, and all throughout my political coming of age, Iowa always had like the most left-wing senator and the most right-wing senator in Congress. And both traditions were very much rooted in populism. The first populist candidate for president in 1892 is Richard Weaver, who was an Iowa representative. So it is a real tradition, and it is a tradition, as you noted, that the sort of movement to rebrand the Democratic Party in the 90s as the party of business, as, you know, the party that embraced global trade accords, that, you know, promoted the knowledge economy over the manufacturing economy. All of that left a lot of the upper Midwest high and dry. And actually, my hometown of Davenport, Iowa, in 1998, Money Magazine named it the worst city in the country to live in, because the farm crisis hit in the 80s and unemployment there went north of 20%. Eventually, what had formerly been the farm implement manufacturing capital of the world became the riverboat gambling capital of the upper Midwest. And, you know, in prior to the caucuses in 2016, there were all of these dispatches from Davenport where, you know, former John Deere workers who had been loyal union members all their lives were breaking for Trump.
Well, this is, you know, this is something that I saw in 2016 again and again. I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting you say Davenport. When I was in Iowa in 2016, I asked somebody the worst place in Iowa and they said Ottumwa. So I went to Ottumwa, which would
anyone from Davenport will say that. But yes,
certainly would have given Davenport a run for its money as the worst place in Iowa. But, you know, it's all over the Midwest and it's all over the Ohio River Valley, too. I mean, that's, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm going to be in Western Pennsylvania next week is to see whether anything has changed under 4 years of Trump and 4 years of Joe Biden. But one thing that has to be said is that Trump had these places on his radar, or at least his campaign had these places on his radar. I remember in 2016, John Fetterman, who was then running a hopeless campaign for the Democratic nomination for Senate, which he lost, took me up the Mon Valley to places like Clairton and McKeesport. And he said, you know, no politician ever comes here. And then like 2 months later, Trump had a rally in McKeesport. Now, you know, this problem, the problem of what do you do when you stop making things and what happens to those jobs and what happens to the people who used to make things is not something certainly that Trump devoted any effort to solving in 4 years in the White House. Although, you know, he got credit for calling in the auto manufacturing owners of the auto companies or CEOs of the auto companies. And, you know, telling them they had to start making more cars in America. That was a thing he actually did. And he got a lot of credit for that from auto workers. And, of course, tariffs on China are popular in those parts of the countries because they view China as having taken their jobs. You know, that's maybe more complicated, but that's how people view it. So I haven't seen Joe Biden do a whole lot to bring joy to these places either, except for infrastructure money, which is not nothing. And with, yeah. But it'll be interesting to see if Waltz and Harris represent more of a substantive or a policy pivot in that direction. So, Alyssa, you pointed out in your piece for The Nation that all of the euphoria that greeted Tim Walz, which I was there on Tuesday, and I saw the euphoria and got caught up in it myself. And one of the things that struck me also was how smartly organized the rally was in terms of having, you know, building from the mayor of Philadelphia to Fetterman to Shapiro to Harris to Walz. And that Shapiro definitely played his part and gave a real barnstormer of a speech, and that they love him in Pennsylvania. It's clear that they love him in Pennsylvania. And it seems that they love Tim Walz in Minnesota, but it also seems that the national love affair for Tim Walz has a little bit of amnesia in it. So what are we forgetting when we only see him as this progressive paragon?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing that made me feel like there was some collected amnesia is just, A, this notion that Minnesota was being introduced to the national or global stage for the first time with Tim Walz when, you know, we were Minneapolis was the epicenter of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020, which was the largest protest movement in this country's history, which it was spread around the globe. And Tim Walz was the governor, you know, during the Minneapolis uprising, as it's been called. And so, you know, I co-authored an academic paper for the journal Mobilization with Anna Del Cortivo. She's a sociologist. She covered the Chauvin trial with me for you guys. And what we did was we kind of analyzed the press conferences that were held during the uprising. And so that version of Tim Walz, you know, I've watched these press conferences over and over. It's just a very different version of Tim Walz. It's not your cool dad next door. It's not your dad at the state fair. It's his inner army surgeon. It's a man speaking the language of law and order, you know, discrediting protesters, saying that the people out in the streets were bringing more destruction to the state than anybody in history ever before. When you know, order is restored, when the operation to kind of calm the uprising is seen as successful, he begins to kind of take credit for mutual aid efforts that arose intentionally outside of the state because it felt like the state was not there for people or not protecting certain people. So, I mean, there are just a lot of communities in Minneapolis. There's a lot of grassroots efforts that still, you know, think of Tim Walz in that capacity of calling the National Guard. And it's interesting because it's actually coming up far more as an attack from the right that he didn't call in the National Guard soon enough. I know the audio recording of Trump actually praising his response, I think, was on the cover of the Times today as well. Along with the story that you referenced. But it's just, I don't know, a really kind of interesting shift because then in response to the rights attack, you have Harris saying, no, Walz, you know, is making Minneapolis safer. He put more cops on the street, you know, he's funding more criminal prosecutors. And so it's just such a stark contrast to 2020 when mass incarceration, racialized police violence are maybe the top issue for a lot of the left, to the degree that Harris wasn't a viable candidate for the presidency then because she had been a prosecutor. I mean, that in that viral clip of Tulsi Gabbard kind of criticizing her record, some say that ended her run for president. And so, I don't know, just this euphoria both around her and around Tim Walz without any mention of the 2020 uprising, it's just been kind of bizarre to watch. The other thing that is kind of, I don't know, interesting or just worth noting is like even this law for free lunch that Walz did sign into law. I mean, that bill was pushed for by Valerie Castile, Philando Castile's mother. And so Philando Castile was killed in 2016 in Falcon Heights, a suburb of St. Paul. His girlfriend live streamed the killing on Facebook. I remember, I wasn't living in Minnesota at the time, but I remember vividly watching it. And Philando was a school cafeteria worker who often paid for kids' lunches out of his own pocket. So after he was killed, his mom, you know, became an activist and raised $200,000 to wipe out school lunch debt and was one of the people pushing for this law. And so it's just, police violence hasn't gone away and it's still a part of the story. It's just not central at the moment.
So I guess my question about that is kind of two parts. And Chris, feel free to jump in on either part. One is, Do we on the left expect too much of our, as it were, our people? In other words, you know, Walz seems to have a progressive record. And you're kind of, if you're the governor of a state where people are protesting injustice, but their protests are causing inconvenience, public disturbance, however you want to characterize it, you're kind of damned if you do or damned if you don't. You know, so I guess one is, can you be a little more specific about how you feel he handled those challenges, incidents, and whether there are things he should have done that he didn't or did do that he shouldn't have, whether they were rhetorical or whether they were policy? And I guess the second is, you know, are we, that which is kind of the broader question is, do we have a kind of perfectionism on the left that's going to get us in the end?
Yeah. So.
The new book, Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, Speeches and Writings, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, gives readers a rare opportunity to engage with the Congresswoman's powerful ideas in her own voice. Many Americans are familiar with Chisholm's importance as the first Black woman in Congress and the first woman and African American to run for president with either major party. This collection of her work establishes Chisholm as an unparalleled public intellectual and Black feminist both in her time and now. Learn more about Shirley Chisholm in Her Own Words, edited by Zynga A. Fraser, at ucpress.edu.
No, I mean, I think that's a valid point because I think I think any Democratic governor that had been in that position probably would have acted the same. So I don't think it's necessarily unique to Waltz, because there is a kind of a bipartisan consensus on a more law and order approach. To me, it almost speaks to more a shift in the party of just how quickly issues around criminal justice went from being really high on the priority list to much lower, despite the fact that not much has changed. And I also think it's just worth pointing out that for all the people in Minnesota that do love Waltz, there just is a constituency. And to be fair, a lot of these people probably, again, may not vote for anybody that would be on the Democratic ticket because they're so far left, or they feel so neglected by, you know, electoral politics. They don't see it as anything more than maybe harm reduction. I'm not sure the critique is unique to Waltz, but I do think it's interesting to see, like, you know, there was a lot of momentum, and I don't know if I would call it euphoria because it was born out of something so terrible, but there's a lot of very real grassroots momentum behind defunding the police, in the sense of, like, the investment in a lot of the social services, the social safety net that Waltz is touting. You know, a lot of people were calling for that to come at the same time that we were going to kind of shrink this carceral state. And so it's just, I think, worth noting that was the original framing of it. And so I do think the progress on the left is fantastic, but something that was really big and really core to the discussion has fallen away in a pretty short period of time.
Yeah. And I think, sort of taking off of that point, you know, I said in a Nation meeting earlier today that general elections are ugly things. And you do see a lot of the, you know, the stuff that, you know, John Shade and company perennially call for, of, you know, prior to a general election, the Democrats always have to pivot to the center. Never mind that the right always pivots continually further to the right, thereby changing where the center is. But and I think, you know, the kind of, I think of, you know, and you obviously have much greater familiarity with Waltz's recent record, but speaking generally, you know, being a governor in a situation like that is a balancing act, and you are facing pressures, you know, not only from grassroots organizers, but of course, you know, the business community in Minneapolis and, you know, the traditional law and order constituencies on the right. So, and, you know, speaking of elections being ugly things, part of me, when I saw the ABC leak of the tape with Trump, is that I thought to myself, oh, you know, the Harris campaign had to know about this tape when they selected Waltz, because it's teeing up, like, what for the right is one of the biggest criticisms, right, of George Floyd protests and the police station burning down in Minneapolis. And then you have Donald Trump on tape saying he's done an excellent job, he's called in the National Guard, blah, blah, blah. None of this is to approve any of, I should strongly stipulate that, in the same way that, you know, just yesterday, in my view, Kamala Harris sort of disgracefully called out Gaza protesters at her Michigan event. And there's that same dance there that, you know, we saw when she issued a statement against the Gaza protesters in Union Square, and then had a meeting with Netanyahu, this is a low bar, but she was better on the issue than Joe Biden was. So it's...
Well, Chris, I'm glad you went there, because you've pointed out a couple of things that have been sort of in my head for the last couple of days. And the first one, and in a way, the one that we're all taking for granted, but that is worth spending at least a moment to acknowledge, is she is doing so much better on all of these issues than Joe Biden did. And, you know, there is such a sense of possibility. Now, you know, sometimes that veers into energy, euphoria, delusion. We're trying not to fall prey to wishful thinking at the Nation. So there's that. And then there is this dance. And, you know, I watched the same tape that you watched, which went viral yesterday. And I guess I saw it a little differently. I saw a collision, and I would love both of your thoughts on this, a sort of inevitable collision between, if you like, identity politics and policy, in that, Harris's response was an identity politics response. It was the, I am a Black woman who has been interrupted her whole life, and I am now running for president, and I'm not going to put up with it. And, you know, I saw lots of cheering for that, particularly from other women of color on X, who really were not fussed about the policy. They were, that's what they got out of it. I don't know how it felt to be in the room if I were a Palestinian activist. And, there are Palestinian activists and pro-Palestine activists and Middle East justice people for whom this is the only issue for them. Just like, there are defund the police activists for whom that's the only issue. The problem with being a single issue activist, in my view, in America is that that means you end up very seldom voting because you find candidates who will never satisfy you on single issues. But I think this is a tension that's inherent in our politics, and I'd be very interested in both of your thoughts on, how this might play itself out, not just yesterday, but going forward. Chris, you want to go first on this? This is sort of your...
Sure. I think, as I was saying earlier, I think it will go forward in largely an ugly fashion. And I think, the important thing, and here I'm quoting Jeet here, our colleague who was engaging with these issues in an earlier meeting, is right now, there is this kind of, I don't know if I would call it euphoria, but as you were saying, a sense of possibility. And that arises in part because Kamala Harris is in many ways a tabula rasa on a lot of these policy questions. And I think it's important to conceptualize the Democratic Party writ large as a coalition with various elements who should right now, I think it's entirely proper for them to be coming forward with, maybe not single issues, but, the issues that matter most to them and wanting clarification. Will a Harris administration consider an arms embargo to Israel if the genocide continues? So that's an entirely reasonable thing to raise at this moment, and it will create friction. And that is, I think, what's healthy about democratic politics, small d democratic politics. And the other thing to keep in mind, to state the obvious, is, Kamala Harris didn't have a primary prior to becoming the nominee. And these are the issues that would conventionally be, weighed in the fullness of time on a traditional primary schedule. So now it's just being kind of, speed time-lapse photography, right? And it's going to be hectic and messy, but I think it's good that we on the left and, liberals more broadly in the Democratic Party embrace, a big tent approach. And, something like Gaza is a huge issue, especially when you consider, the vote in Michigan, another critical swing state with a big Arab American population, and the youth vote, which was absolutely essential to Joe Biden's election in 2020. So it's important to have these issues out. And what was disappointing in my view, I get what you're describing as the identity politics response from Harris, but there needs to be a different tone of she started off saying, we're a democracy, it's important to hear your voices, but then pivoted immediately to shutting down their voices. So there has to be a different tone that, like, yes, this is a very serious issue and we need to grapple with it in a fun.
Yeah. I agree. I saw that clip, the I'm speaking response to the protesters, and I felt like it was foreshadowing of what's to come, and where it could, to borrow from Chris, get ugly. I think Gaza is already the big elephant in the room, and I think it's only a matter of time before it becomes far more central to this election. I think part of the reason that, you know, Waltz was chosen was, you know, because he's not Shapiro, and I think Harris has kind of made some gains just by not being Biden, and so then I think for people who just couldn't vote for Biden because of Genocide Joe, because of, you know, what's been happening since October 7th, it kind of gives this degree of separation that I think has allowed for this excitement to emerge. But I just think it could also dissolve quite quickly. And so I think if she had chosen Shapiro, I think it could have alienated a lot of people that she had just won over. I mean, Shapiro volunteered on an Israeli army base when he was young. He had made comments comparing pro-Palestinian protesters to the KKK. The whole time I was kind of seeing Waltz and thinking he was going to get chosen, I was like, yeah, it's partially because he's an educator and a football coach and, you know, signed into law this free lunch program. But it's also because he's not Shapiro. The question is, we don't really know super, again, there's no primary. We don't really know where they stand with regards to Israel-Palestine. I mean, there have been protests here for months now, many of them outside the governor's mansion, calling on the state of Minnesota to divest from Israel. Some people have kind of, noted that Harris thus far has had quote unquote softer rhetoric than Biden, pushing Netanyahu to take the deal. But I think it's worth noting, like, when this single issue is like, it's a genocide that is extremely violent and persistent and live streamed for many people. And so I do think that for the people for whom, you know, this is the number one issue, I think there's not that much wiggle room. And so, I mean, I will be curious to see how they react, how they act, where they kind of, you know, stand on Israel-Palestine. But I don't know, we haven't really, I know the uncommitted movement is saying they're not going to get behind Harris until we have a better sense of her stance. But I also think it could come more into the spotlight, A, if things escalate in the Middle East, which is kind of expected in the wake of the assassination in Iran last week of Hamas's top political leader. It also, I think, could potentially be more in the spotlight if we see a resurgence of campus protests when students are back to school in the fall. I think it could be more in the spotlight as we approach October 7th, which would be a 365 days of genocide. I think there are just, I don't think it can remain the elephant in the room. And I think kind of that I'm speaking clip was a preview. And I will be curious to see if they actually change course.
Yeah, no, I will too. I mean, I confess that when I saw the clip by itself, I was disgusted. And I thought this is a stage sister soldier moment, you know, of dissing the left. But it doesn't appear, when you sort of see the whole context and you realize that she met with them earlier that day, to be that. And then they issued a statement afterwards, which was clearly trying to un-sister soldier it. And I thought that was a good move. I think you're both right that this is going to be a very difficult issue for Harris and Waltz going forward. And I don't think there's a lot. I mean, you know, there is just this. The problem is that most Americans don't actually care, but the Americans who do care about this on both sides, which is to say pro-Palestinian people and supporters of justice for Palestine and Zionists, are passionate about it. And they care a lot. And you know, and in some states they vote a lot, and in other states they bankroll state parties. So it's not really something you can ignore, and it's not really something you can take a strong position on without alienating people who you'd probably prefer not to alienate. So, you know, it is definitely a test of political deftness. But also, I thought Harris took what may be the only respectable way out, which is to say, I know I'm not as good on this as you would like, but, you know, Donald Trump is going to be a lot worse, so you should think about that. I mean, that's not going to work for every issue, but on this issue, that may be about as good as you can expect. I wondered whether either of you thought that having Walt in this race changes the political map. You know, this is a horse race show. We've been talking about policy, but I want to know about states that are going to go blue or states that are going to go red. And does he put states in play that were not otherwise in play?
Well, there are states in play that were not prior to this moment in play. I believe Georgia, Nevada, Arizona have all sort of moved from the Trump column over the past 3 weeks to toss-up status, essentially. And places like New Hampshire is now leaning Democratic. So that is a very noteworthy shift. It's something to, recur once again to the elite punditocracy. All of these people who were Biden dead enders were saying, oh, this will be a disaster for the Democrats if we swap out the ticket. We've built up all these organizations and field offices in the states to elect Joe Biden. What's going to happen then? So my first response to your question is never underestimate the ability of professional pundits to get the map totally wrong. And my second point is, we tend to fetishize this idea of the map as a set of received political rigid truisms that can never be broken out of. And the fact of the matter is that, in many ways, the challenge of politics is to change the map. And I think that's why the Waltz, that's the most appealing thing to me about the Waltz pick, apart from the sort of, incremental weighing of whether he was, certainly I believe he was better than Shapiro or Kelly or, I think the idea, without really intending to, what's happened in this cycle is the Democrats have backed their way largely through sheer inertia and incompetence into a movement campaign, right? This is what they have. And it's very fascinating because I think MAGA right now is not a movement. It is the sclerotic establishment that's slow to adapt. And this is a moment where you have to kind of be, and this is why I'm encouraged by Harris's choice, you have to be nimble and you have to see beyond the kind of tunnel vision of oh my God, without Josh Shapiro, we're going to lose Pennsylvania. The fact of the matter is Democrats have won Pennsylvania 7 out of the last 8 cycles, which as David Kleon wrote at the time, that he did a sort of piece arguing against Shapiro is like, the key to winning Pennsylvania is not to be Hillary Clinton. And
Harris has
again cleared a low bar, right? I think it will take a lot of political, coordination and imagination to sort of, you can now say to Josh Shapiro, okay, your task is to bring in Pennsylvania the same way Whitmer's task in Michigan is to bring in Michigan, Evers in Wisconsin, et cetera, and have, Tim Walz be what I think we all kind of agree he's best at, as like this kind of symbolic cool dad figure who is reassuring to a lot of people who think of the Democrats as whatever,
the party of people with multiple piercings.
Right, exactly. The kind of, what the Republican Party wants you to believe the Democratic Party is. So at that level, I think it's a significant pit. I also think, this is again to pan back to the prairie populist analysis, but what I've been saying, again, I'm like the least influential pundit imaginable, but ever since 2016, I would get into these recursive arguments with my peer community in Washington about, what happened in that cycle. And, one reason people forget that the blue wall was christened in 2012 was Barack Obama bailed out the auto industry. after the 2008 meltdown, when his opponent, Mitt Romney, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying essentially, let it burn. And that rescued an entire regional economy just because the auto industry is, you know, this vast network of parts suppliers, a big supply chain all throughout the region. So in 2016, you were back to the standard neoliberal democratic line of, well, move to a more vibrant community and learn to code, right? And, you know, yes, Hillary did not campaign in Wisconsin, which was an unbelievably stupid tactical error, but she also didn't have a great deal to run on. So I think, you know, again, my hope, this is speaking very big picture, is that the selection of Walz and, you know, he does have a solid social democratic record as governor, is a long overdue course correction for the Democrats.
So Ron DeSantis ran his unsuccessful, sadly, only because he was such ample material for comedy there every day, campaign on the theory that he wanted to make America Florida. Do you think make America Minnesota is more...
Make America Minnesota nice would be a good step in the right direction.
Is that something that has legs, as they say?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I have some loose theories that are not, you know, super fleshed out, but I kind of have been saying for a minute now, before Walz was picked, and not even in the context of an election, I was kind of predicting a rise of the Midwest, where I think we'll see more people actually moving inland, potentially moving away from the coast for a variety of reasons. But I also do think there's this embrace of a simpler, you know, Midwest lifestyle that I think was kind of mocked very, very recently, that, like you're saying, I think actually can have an impact on the electoral map. I don't know. I mean, it's just worth noting that Minnesota, Minneapolis, for one, has also a very rich organizing history, like leftist history outside of electoral politics. I mean, birthplace of the American Indian movement, you have the uprising in 2020. I think all of these things, all of those grassroots efforts and kind of grassroots organizing still do feed into a lot of the things that Walz did. He was being pushed by local activists. So I just do think, I think there's a lot here that to me it's still in the early stages of really kind of like blooming and blossoming. And I think Tim Walz as a selection and how well he's being received to me is an indicator of that, an indicator of a broader trend.
Well, it's interesting to me that apparently one of the things that sunk Shapiro, aside from, you know, all of the press stuff and the people pushing very hard who are exactly the people you would want to push back against, was that when he spoke with Harris, he said, well, tell me how you see this relationship, meaning, you know, how much power would I have and how much would be in my basket, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to ask for a vice president. It's certainly most vice presidents since Al Gore have asked some form of that question. Not all of them have had answers as expansive as Gore got. Harris, in a sense, didn't ask that question. And as a result, the answer was, we're going to give you every hopeless job in the administration just to make sure that we don't have to ever worry about you being a threat. Because, you know, this is another thing that has become obvious in the last few months, but that people never seem to talk about, which is that Joe Biden was always a terrible campaigner. He was a terrible campaigner, you know, in 1988. And he was a terrible campaigner in 2020. He kept on losing primaries while there were primaries to lose. Then he did very well on Super Tuesday. Jim Clyburn rescued him. And then they shut down the primary schedule, lest he have to face Bernie in a primary that he might have lost again. So, you know, this was not a campaign that you got excited about going to events for ever. Whereas now Harris is able to do that. She is able to draw crowds on at least a Trumpian scale. And, you know, that's traditionally a function of what candidates are supposed to do. What remains unanswered to me and is going to be interesting is to see whether there's a mesh between her kind of coastal Silicon Valley, which is not about the Rust Belt, it is not about manufacturing, it is not even really about the dignity of labor, sensibility. You know, it's a kind of coastal racial justice, identitarian, in some senses, techno-utopian sensibility, which also is the sensibility behind some of her biggest donors. You know, how that is going to mesh with Walz's Midwestern, like, you know, we can't, not everybody can move to Seattle and learn to code. I mean, there's a prospect for either a useful tension or a productive tension or a destructive one there. I wonder, you know, maybe we should go out with your thoughts on their evolving relationship. I mean, another thing that struck me in Philly at the, in the auditorium is they haven't figured out yet how to be in the same space. And that's a problem for any male and female candidate, whoever's the top of the ticket and whoever's the bottom of the ticket. In a sense, with Biden, he was so desexualized that it didn't matter. But with Harris and Walz, you can see them coming to give each other a hug and then not hugging too much. And then, you know, going in as if you might give a person a kiss, but definitely not kissing. And it's like they're going to have to work that out, too. I mean, I wonder whether you had any thoughts on any of that, from substance to style.
Sure. I would, first of all, just note that discomfort with public intimacy is another well-known Midwestern trait. So I don't think gender essentialism has to enter into it. But I do think, and one of, you know, again, one of the encouraging things to me is that Kamala Harris did choose Walz, knowing that, you know, there were these kind of stylistic and cultural sensibility differences. But I think, you know, it's also important to remember that Harris has been, you know, the chief, not only, you know, as you were suggesting earlier, the chief sort of policy janitor for the Biden administration, but the chief kind of cheerleader. You know, she cast 31 tie-breaking votes to get critical legislation through Congress and for Biden to sign into law. And that included stuff like the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS bill, you know, stuff that is the IRA, obviously, which is very ambitious legislation, both to revive and to retool the manufacturing economy that we have. So I think they're closer together is what I'm saying, all, you know, in the bigger picture on these policy issues than their biographies suggest. And I think, again, to sort of go back to where, in my view, the Democratic Party started going astray in the 90s, you know, this is, as I was saying earlier, a long overdue recognition of, you know, the part of the country that, and the sort of social and class geography that the party has been kind of militantly ignoring for 30 years. So it's not going to, you know, cohere automatically on the basis of a single vice presidential pick. But I do think, you know, there is an encouraging path opening up for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think that divide is just a bit different these days for a variety of reasons. But I do think the internet, which is a broad trend to point to, but I think the internet and COVID really just kind of changed a lot how a lot of people work. And so I think even in the Midwest, you have a lot of people who you do have people who are coding or who are doing jobs you might associate with New York and San Francisco, but now they live someplace cheaper. And that's completely possible because of the degree to which COVID has changed work. So I do think that tension, I don't think it necessarily exists. And I think they're kind of a nice balance to each other in that way. And I think, kind of like what Chris said, I think the beauty of branding yourself as the candidate of the people versus being a career politician like Biden is that when Biden says something like weird or awkward, everyone sees it as like incompetence. And I think when you're the, when you have the Tim Walz persona, that awkwardness, I think, can actually, people will be like, oh, he is just like us. I don't know. I've seen a meme going around that's like, Walz makes history as the first person from Minnesota to socialize beyond his childhood group of friends, you know? So like, I think it just plays well. And the other thing that I just wanted to say that's related, but a bit more tangentially, but it is a positive point to end on. I know I've brought a bit of like a negative Wednesday Adams vibe to the function at times this week, but there is also a lot of excitement here about the fact that if Walz does win and moves into the White House, that the lieutenant governor is Penny Flanagan, and she would be the first Native American governor in U.S. history. And so that actually, to me, feels like there's as much excitement around that possibility as Walz himself. So I am, very curious to see how it all plays out.
It's also worth noting that both Penny Flanagan was Walz's teacher at the Wellstone Institute. And I think Paul Wellstone is an important figure to acknowledge here. He was, of course, a left Democratic senator who tragically died in a plane crash in the, I think, early aughts. But that is, a pretty direct lineage that is being revived at this moment. And it's a really valuable one. The only other thing I wanted to add is kind of a weird epilogue is, I wrote my post for The Nation right after Walz was announced, and I wound up talking about the failure of the Howard Dean's 50-state strategy in 2006 as, another benchmark in what I think of as, bunker type Democratic thinking of just guarding your assets and not expanding the map. And I didn't realize it at the time, but later reports during that fateful 2006 cycle where Howard Dean, then head of the DNC, was battling with Rahm Emanuel, head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, over how to fund critical congressional races, there was a fight over this. Tim Walz was running that year, and a Democratic figure went to Rahm Emanuel and said, look, there's this guy in Minnesota. He's in this traditionally Republican district, but he's a really special candidate, and I think he can win. And Rahm replied basically saying, no way are we going to back this guy. He doesn't have any money. So
let's dance on Rahm Emanuel's grave whenever we can.
Exactly. And that anecdote does just say a lot about Democratic Party's past and future.
So. No, I think we will do a whole episode sometime about the battles within the Democratic Party and the future of the Democratic Party. And I think some of these things will play themselves out in Chicago. I feel like there's a kind of energy on the left of the party that wasn't there a month ago. So stay tuned. But thank you both, Chris Lehman, the Nation's Washington correspondent, and Alyssa Ausler. And Alyssa is the author of Fear and Self-Loathing on the 24 Election Trail, which is a Substack that I urge you all to subscribe to. Because she writes for The Nation from time to time, and we're delighted. But if you want to be as well informed as you can, then you should subscribe to her Substack as well. And it's been great talking to you, and I look forward to talking again soon. Thank you both. Take care.